You know, all over the world, it's generally universally held belief that the name of an object, whether it's a man, woman, higher being, more than a mere labeling, that it is incidentally related with one who bears it. It's more than just an incidental labeling. The name is believed to be the indispensable part of the personality of whatever is bearing it. One might say that a person is body, soul, and name. You hardly can separate yourself from your name. If you go back in history, in Homer's writings, he said that the name of a person or thing is given by the parents in an attempt to make something good happen to them. Something good is going to, an omen, so to speak. If you give this person a beautiful name that's going to be achieving something or it's going to do great, that person is considered, okay, they'll grow up to that name. Well, we know already that people name a person after either an uncle, an aunt, a father, a mother, and there's an implication in that, right? That you're supposed to sort of be like that person. If you're named for that person, you're supposed to be like that person. Now, the Greek word for name is onoma. The Hebrew word for the word name is shem. In the time of the great philosophers wrestled with this philosophy and this problem of the power and significance of a name. Does that name have power? Does it have significance? Go back to the 6th century B.C., 4th century B.C., the rational philosophers looked at the issue. They began to check what happens, they said, when there are two names for the same person, or God, or object. Which one, they wanted to know, has the magical power of that name? In Plato's day, the view was widespread that the nature of things is best known from their names. Well, what is it? How do you look at the nature of a person? If her name was beautiful, would she be beautiful? If her name, is she supposed to be beautiful? If her name is ugly, is she supposed to be ugly? Or is he supposed to be crude or rude if his name is rude? Well, I mean, what does that name carry some form of direct power? That's what they wanted to know. The philosophers had to deal with this. In opposition to this, Plato had put deeper question of the relationship between word and concept, between thought and speech. Plato realized that many bad things have names which, when you trace them etymologically, prove to be good. You know, they have a good name. A bad thing can have a good name. So he also realized that a good thing can have a bad name. Aristotle generally agreed with Plato's view. He stated plainly that the sound of a name doesn't itself bear the meaning of the name, but he thought it was first to appropriate the meaning as significant. For instance, a rose. If you called a rose a skunk, what would that rose change its actual physical fragrance? Would the rose change its looks because you called it by a different name? So Aristotle said, you know, you can call it what you want, but the thing is what it is. And we have the old phrase, the rose by any other name would still be as beautiful and probably smell just as sweet. Unless you are a person given to internal ideas about a name. Unless you are hypnotized by a name. If you're hypnotized by the name yourself, then if somebody called it a skunk, you would then smell something odor, very, very pungent in odor, and you wouldn't like it if you yourself are given to hypnotic work. Now, this is how hypnosis works. You know, hypnosis works through sounds that make you think that the thing that you're hearing or seeing or the things that they're saying are an actual fact, a reality, when they are not. I do know as a psychologist that you can, that names have some sort of effect on the mind and the bearing of a person. For instance, an ugly sounding or embarrassing name. If you named your child an ugly sounding, embarrassing name, you wouldn't be doing them any favors. Most of us don't like to do that. We like to give our children a very nice name. But we try to avoid a name that's embarrassing. You wouldn't want to name your boy Susan. You know, when they say a boy named Sue learns to fight a lot as he grows up. If you want to make him tough, you know, you name him Sue, and then people make fun of him. He's always fighting about his name. How many movie stars do you know that changed their name? Izzy Iskowitz. You know who Izzy Iskowitz was? Eddie Cantor, a famous person in the 40s, entertainer. Eddie, he changed his name because Izzy Iskowitz wouldn't do well. And even famous newscaster Paul Harvey did not use his last name. Ararat was his last name, and he wouldn't use it because it wasn't. So he just used his first name and his middle name. So he just called himself Paul Harvey. Leonard Sly, Roy Rogers, Norma Jean Doherty, Marilyn Monroe. When you look back at the so-called magic papyri, that is a bunch of papyrus writings on papyrus, and the so-called magic papyri are full of expressions showing belief in the power and efficacy of names. People went into magic. They started thinking about a name as... It expresses these papyri express the primitive belief that knowledge of names gives power over their bearers. If I have the knowledge of your name, I can call you, I can get you to do things, that name can put a spell on its owner, and it brings him or her under the power of the speaker. You speak that name, it brings that person, God, or deity, or angel, or person. Sometimes the name of a person that one wishes to harm has only to be written on a piece of paper or elsewhere, and then you put this magical formula over this name, and then this person is harmed. Because they thought that name, you name that person and curse that person or curse that name, and that actually would reach out and hurt the person. If a man utters the name of a god, you know, now in the Greeks they had the many gods, various, and then demands or asks something of that god, it was to be fulfilled. And because he speaks the name, the mystic even identifies himself with the god. For you are I, and I am you, says the mystic. You know, these magical people. I am you, because once I utter your name, I am you, and you are I. Your name is mine, and mine is yours. In these magic papers, one must invoke the true name or the magical name of his or her god. The name works by itself, they said. It is a powerful essence, a hypostasis, or a hypostasis of the god. It is the essence of the god, which, when invoked, is set in motion and in operation. You say that name of the god, you name that god, and it sets things in motion. The secret name, once invoked presses through all heavenly worlds and comes to the earth. You know, remember, they believed in a lot of gods up running around in heaven and converting and everything. The Greeks had all kinds of superstitions. Before the sound of this name, the earth opens, the rivers and the rocks burst, demons tremble and flee by utterance of the supreme name. This is how they had in their superstition. From the 4th century, Christian magi had the papyrus. Now, we're not going not from B.C., but to A.D. These mention the names of Mary, John the Baptist, and the Trinity as efficacious. If you cite, if you pray in Mary's name, something powerful will happen. That's the 4th century A.D. In 400 years after Christ, things started falling apart. There was a lot of superstition. You could see, if you read the book of John, the Gospel of John carefully, you could see John anticipated that this would happen. Consequently, the Gospel of John takes John the Baptist and Mary, the mother of Jesus, to a lower status. You'll see it, because John's the last gospel. And already they must have been doing things to elevate these people. Let me read to you from John chapter 1. Let's begin in chapter 1. Let's drop down to verse 19. Because they were asking John. John is out baptizing, if you remember, by the River Jordan. He's out baptizing. People come up to him and they say, "Well, who are you? What are you doing?" And this is what the scripture says now in verse 19. "This is the testimony of John when the Jews sent to him priests, Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, 'Who are you?' And he confessed." Now, I want you to notice the wording of the book of John here in verse 20. Okay? "He confessed and did not deny, but confessed." I mean, listen to the emphasis on his testimony. He confessed. He didn't deny. He confessed. "I am not the Christ." So right away, John is making it, John, the gospel writer of John the gospel writer, is saying John the Baptist cannot be confused with the Messiah. Because he confessed it. He didn't deny it. He said, "I'm not the Christ." They asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" Now remember, there was the prophet. Who was the prophet? You see it in the book of Deuteronomy. There was going to be the prophet who came like unto Moses, who was going to do all these things. Well, he said, "I'm not the prophet." What does he say when they ask you, "Are you the prophet?" He said, "No." So I'm not the prophet. I'm not Elijah. Remember, Elijah was supposed to come and set all things correct. I'm not the prophet. I'm not Elijah. I'm not the Christ. I'm not the Messiah. Then they said to him, "Well, who are you? So that we may give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?" He says, "I am the voice." And now he's quoting now. "I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as Isaiah the prophet said." He's quoting from Isaiah. Now, they had been sent from the Pharisees. They asked him and said to him, "Why then are you baptizing?" Now, I want you to notice how John's gospel summarizes ahead, again, what they just said. They asked him and said to him, this is verse 25, "Why then are you baptizing if you are not the Christ, not Elijah, nor the prophet? Why are you baptizing?" John answered them, saying, "I baptize with water." And I want you to notice the next phrase. "But among you stands one whom you do not know. It is he who comes after me." It's not me. It's one coming after me. "The thong of whose sandal I am not worthy to untie." I'm reading that from the New American Standard Version. "Not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal." So John's gospel already, because they anticipating that they would get into this magical thing of Mary and John the Baptist and the Trinity, saying, John's gospel already. Now I want you to notice what he does, what John's gospel does with Mary. Mary, the Virgin Mary. The Virgin Mary, okay? First of all, John's gospel does not refer to the virgin birth. That's only referred to in Matthew and Luke. Even Mark's gospel doesn't refer to it. So only Matthew and Luke. But in John's gospel, I want you to read chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. And listen to this phrase. And the mother of Jesus was there. He does not use her first name. He doesn't say anything more about her than she was his mother. The Gospel of John, the last gospel written before all this superstition and magical things with names and incantations and the worship of Mary. You know, as you know, some churches put Mary on a pedestal. They worship, they pray to Mary. John's gospel says, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus, I want you to notice that in verse 3. Once again, she's the mother of Jesus, said to him, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, woman, madam, what does that have to do with us? Madam, what does that have to do with us? Okay. Woman here is not a derogatory name. It's a very polite way that you would address people. My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Just do whatever he says. Verse 12, John 2 and verse 12. After this, he went down to Capernaum. He and his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days. Now you'll notice John's gospel does not mention in this first part the name of his mother. Now, I think you get into the last part when he's on the cross and all that. He says, woman, this is your, he says to John, this is your mother, this is your son on the cross. But he doesn't mention the name. He's de-emphasizing John the Baptist, de-emphasizing Mary, Jesus' mother. Even on pagan soil, there were always thinking people who opposed this belief in names and name magic. Thus, Lucian, L-U-C-I-A-N, Lucian was known as Lucian of Samosata. He was a Syrian satirist. He was a rhetorician, rhetoric, who is best known for his tongue-in-cheek style of making fun of superstitions and even religious practices that didn't make sense and belief in the paranormal. He lived between 120 AD and 192 AD. So he was very close in time to the apostles and to John the apostle. But even then, these pagans coming in started to think in terms of all these superstitions. Lucian scoffed at the stupidity of those who think that a boil or a fever will vanish through awe at a name of some god. You know, if you just name this god, you know. And many people, have you ever seen people riding with these little things on their dashboard? It's like a little icon, a little idol, little, it's called a saint. They put some kind of saint on there. He's supposed to be the saint of protection. And up in heaven are supposed to be all these saints. You pray to this saint, to that saint, to some other saint. And these saints are supposed to give you all these protections. Did you ever see that? These people said about Lucian that you must not believe in God at all. They thought that those who were skeptical of the power of names didn't believe in gods at all. In the Old Testament, the name, as I said, in Hebrew is Shem. The word Shem is used 770 times in the Old Testament in the singular. It's singular place. and 84 times in the plural, names. So those names refer, the Shem refers to geographical sites, to entities, to towns, to mountains, to rivers, to things, to times, to stars, to pillars, to anything. Okay? Shem can be good or bad or indifferent. There are bad Shems. You name it because this person has been bad, or that person, this thing is bad. The significance of a name is the power attached to it. People live on and through their children. And throughout the Old Testament, a sense of significance of proper names is readily seen. Readily seen. You see it here. The best known one. I'm going to read a couple of verses here. 1 Samuel chapter 25 and verse 25. This is Abigail. Abigail, David came up onto their ranch and asked the owner of the ranch, Abigail's husband, for some food, some water. He said, "You know, we protected your sheep from people taking them away. We guarded them. We corralled them. We didn't use them. We didn't kill them. Could we have some stuff?" And he said, "No." He was not going to do anything for them. And so, in 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 25, Abigail is pleading for her husband's life because David said, "I'm just going to come down there and kill him because he's so irascible." And so in verse 25, "Please do not let my Lord," meaning David, "pay attention to this worthless man." Her husband. He's calling her husband this worthless man. "Nabal, for as his name is, so is he." Fool. Foolish. He's stupid. He's obstinate. He's foolish. "Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." That means foolishness. "But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." In other words, if I had seen them, I would have given them money. So don't pay attention to my husband. He's as his name is, so is he. He's just foolish. Now, was he foolish from birth? Now, we don't know when they named him. You'll see in some places, they name things as it happens. For instance, Noah, God named Noah as a prophetic name. Noah's name was prophetic, and it came about. What was Noah's name? What did it mean? It meant comfort or rest. Because if you remember that time, the curse that was on the earth, remember the curse that was on the earth? "In the sweat of your brow, well, you bring forth the food and you'll eat it, and it'll be so difficult for you. I'm going to curse the earth with thorns and thistles and things, and you're going to work so hard to get food." And then he said, "The day will come." So notice Genesis 5, verse 29. "Now he called his name Noah, saying, 'This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands, arising from the ground which the Eternal has cursed.'" Noah was going to give them rest. They were just working so hard to just eke out food because he cursed the earth. "In the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat." You eat vegetables. A lot of you plant gardens, you put in squash, you put in tomatoes. I mean, how much sweat did you do for that? Not very much. You planted a little bit, and then you just let it grow. In that day, you planted, you had to work on it, you had to work on it, you had to strive on it all the time because the ground was cursed. Today, the ground is not cursed like that. We're cursing it ourselves because we spray it with every kind of poison chemical and use all this chemical fertilizer and don't take care of it. We wear it out. And even then, we wear out that soil. And even then, it produces all kinds of fruits, vegetables, and plants and stuff that even reduced in its nutritional value, still keep us alive and still keep us healthy. Let's take a look at Isaac's name. What was Isaac's name? Laughter. You remember? Why? Because when Sarah heard that, yes, I will come this time next year and Sarah shall bear a child, and she laughed within herself. Yeah, we tell. And he said, why did you laugh? And she said, I didn't laugh. Oh, yeah, he said, you laughed. God knew what was going on inside her. She didn't laugh out loud. She laughed within herself. Okay? Jacob. Why was Jacob's name Jacob? Genesis chapter 25, verse 26. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. Esau was the firstborn. But here came Jacob as a twin brother holding on to his heel. So his name was called Jacob, the supplanter, the guy who pulls you, trips you up. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. This is Genesis chapter 25, verse 26. So his name was Jacob. You'll see over here in Genesis 27, verse 36, how Esau talked to him. Remember? Listen to what Esau said. Then he said, Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. He's crying to his father Isaac, don't you have? And he says, have you not reserved the blessing for me? Don't I have any blessings at all? Esau got another name. He came out all hairy, but at one point they changed his name to Edom, E-D-O-M, which meant red. In chapter 25 and verse 25, now the first one came out red all over with a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. But later on, his name was changed to Edom. You see in chapter 25, verse 30, and Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. What was that red stuff? That was his lentil soup, his lentil stuff. Therefore, his name was called Edom. They changed his name. He started calling him Edom. People change names. I have a wonderful brother-in-law for many years. His actual name was John David. First name and last name. I mean, first and middle name. John David Hammer. But when he was young, they were learning how to box. He was kind of portly. He had a little weight on him, and they started calling him Tony Galento. You know, Tony. Hey, Tony, you Tony to Galento, and the word Tony stuck. And all through his life, we never called him John. We never called him David ever. We called him Tony. His name was Tony Hammer. But that's not his real name. He wasn't christened with that. It's not on his birth certificate. His name was John David. But he was always called Tony, and it stuck all his life. So names stick. They stick with you. Now, was he a famous boxer because we named him Tony? No. He didn't go into boxing at all. Names show significance for the bearer and for those around him. For instance, Joseph. The word Joseph means he increases. That's what Joseph meant back in the Old Testament. But notice what Pharaoh called him. Pharaoh, Genesis chapter 41 and verse 45. Then Pharaoh named Joseph, a long name here, Zephenath-Paneah, which means God speaks and he lives. God speaks, he lives. Two names. God speaks, he lives. And he gave him his daughter, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. So Joseph's name was changed. Joseph's name, and he increases. And didn't he increase? He did increase a lot. All his life. Now they changed names. People change names. You can change names from this to that. Some people change their names. I mean, look at the movie stars who've changed their names, all kinds of them. In 2 Kings, we see this change of names. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 34. Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, which means God sets up, the son of Josiah. Eliakim was the son of Josiah, the king in the place of Josiah. He made him the king. Now, the Pharaoh Necho made him king in place of Josiah, his father, and changed his name from Eliakim, which meant God sets up, to Jehoiakim, which means God raises up. From God sets up to God raises up. But he took Jehoaz away and brought him to Egypt, and he died there. 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 17 now. Then the king of Babylon made his uncle Mataniah, which meant gift of Yah, the gift of Yahweh, gift of Yah, the king in his place, and he changed his name from Mataniah to Zedekiah, which meant Yah is righteous. Yah is righteousness. Yah is righteousness. They changed names. The Babylonians, when Daniel went there, what did he do? The first thing he did was change names. He changed Daniel's name from Daniel, okay, which meant God is my judge. This is Daniel 1, verse 7. He assigned him the name Belteshazzar, not to be confused with Belshazzar. This is Belteshazzar, which meant protect his life. That's what it meant. Protect his life. He changed Hananiah to Shadrach, Mishael to Meshach, and Azariah to Abednego. He changed all their names to Babylonian names. Okay? So, here's Daniel. His name is changed to a Babylonian name. Now, did that change Daniel? Did it make him a different kind of person? Was he not as righteous as he was before? Could he not pray to God? No. Didn't have any effect on who he was. So God can change that. Now, sometimes God himself changes a person's name. God changes it. Look at Genesis 32 and verse 27. And he said to him, what is your name? This is Jacob. You remember Jacob was wrestling with this angel, angel of God, you know. What is your name? The angel says to him. And he says, Jacob. Jacob, supplant you, you know. Yeah, Jacob is wrestling. And he said to him, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. It means you prevailed with God. You prevailed with El. El is God. You prevailed. You have overcome. You're an overcomer with God. You've conquered. So he changed his name. God changed it. In Genesis chapter 17, verse 5, he changed Abraham's name. This is in Genesis 17, verse 5. No longer shall your name be called Abram. Now the word Abram meant exalted father. You're an exalted father, Abram. But your name shall be Abraham, which meant father of a multitude, father of many, father of a multitude. For I will make you father of a multitude of nations. You're going to be father of a multitude of people. So God himself changes the name of what I'm going to do with you. You haven't been there yet, but I'm going to do something with you. I'm changing your name to what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to read that in the, in verse 15 now, I'm sorry. In verse 15, he changed Sarah from Sarai, your wife, to Sarah. For her, Sarah, her name shall be called. But basically, they both meant princess. She was a princess. In Isaiah 62 and verses 1 and 2, he says here, for Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep quiet until her righteousness goes forth like brightness and her salvation like a torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness and all kings your glory, and you will be called, here's a new, by a new name, which the mouth of the Eternal will designate. I'm going to call Jerusalem by a new name, which God will designate. And in Zechariah, we see a little bit about that new name. Thus, this is Zechariah 8, verse 3. Zechariah 8, verse 3. Thus says the Eternal, I will return to Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Then Jerusalem will be called, what's it going to be called? The City of Truth. And the mountain of the Eternal of Hosts will be called the Holy Mountain. Jerusalem, by the way, is up on a mountain. It's up on the top of a mountain. And that mountain will be called the Holy Mountain, and Jerusalem, the City of Truth in the future. It's not a city of truth right now. So God changes names. Many names are given by what happens. An old joke goes sort of like this. It says, the Indian boy walks up to his mother and he says, Mama, why is my sister called Shining Moon? She said, oh, because when Mama gives birth, she saw a shining moon, so she named your sister Shining Moon. Well, why is brother called Running Bear? He said, oh, because when your mother was going giving birth to him, we saw a bear running across the plain there. Named him Running Bear. Said, oh, okay. Why do you ask? Two dogs breeding. So anyhow, everybody's named something. Whatever the mother saw, or whatever you are, or whatever you did, you are going to have some kind of things that happen. People name things by what they happen. Jacob was named because his hand came out on the foot of his son, of his brother. Esau was named because he was all hairy and red. And then he liked red things, and his name was Edom. There's called a Shem concept, Shem, which is the name of something. Now, when Moses was introduced to this burning bush and a voice said, go, I want you to go and tell my people, let Pharaoh tell my people, let them go. Tell Pharaoh, let my people go. Moses said, well, what if they ask me what our God's name is? And he said, you tell them, I am that I am, or I am that I will be. In other words, I am the ever-living. And it's a tetragrammaton. It's four Hebrew letters. It can be J-H-Y-V-H or J-H-W-H or Y-H-V-H or Y-H-W-H. And Y-H-W-H dwells in heaven, but he chooses a place to cause his Shem, his name, to dwell here on earth. Take a look at what you'll see how God treats his name. Deuteronomy 12, verse 5. But you shall seek the Eternal at the place which the Eternal your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. Where are you supposed to go? Where God places his name. Verse 11, Deuteronomy 12, dropping down to verse 11. Then it shall come about that the place in which the Eternal your God will choose for his name to dwell. It's almost like the name is like a power in itself. The name will dwell there. There you shall bring all that I command you of your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, and your contributions of your hand, and your choice votive offerings, which you will vow to the Eternal. Deuteronomy 14, verse 23. You shall eat in the presence of the Eternal your God at the place where he chooses to establish his name. The tithe, what are you going to eat there? The tithe of your grain, your wine, new wine, your oil, the first thing, firstborn of your herd and flock, so that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. If the distance is so great, this is verse 24, Deuteronomy 14, verse 24, the distance is so great for you that you are not able to bring the tithe, since the place where the Eternal your God chooses to set his name is too far away from you, when the Eternal your God blesses you, is too far away, then and so on. And then you're supposed to turn it into money and all that. Deuteronomy 16, verse 11. And you shall rejoice before the Eternal your God, you and your son, your daughter, your male and female servants, your Levite that is in your town, and the stranger that is, and the orphan and the widow that are in your midst, in the place where the Eternal your God chooses to establish his name. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 24. And you shall make an altar of the earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen, in every place where I cause my name to be remembered. I will come to you and bless you. This name, he places it somewhere, the name. And we'll see why. This name almost takes on like a material thing. It's like, you know, I'm going to place this over here, this name, I'm going to put it here, it's going to be there. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 13. Talking about Solomon, David. He shall build a house for my name. Not for me. What's the house for? For my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. 1 Kings 3 and verse 2. The people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Eternal, the Yahweh, the Jehovah, the Jehovah. There was no house built for the name in those days. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 17. Now it was in the heart of my father. This is Solomon now talking. It was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Eternal, the God of Israel. So God sets his name in a place. And he sanctifies. They sanctifies that place. He makes that place holy for his name. Notice in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 3. This is God speaking here. The Eternal said to him, I have heard your prayer. Now this is after Solomon had his long prayer. I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house, which you have built. Here's how he consecrated the house, by putting my name there forever, or as long as condition. Now, you understand the word forever in the Bible does not mean the same as we have in English. We think forever just goes on and nothing will stop it. Forever means as long as conditions continue. If God says, I promise you forever you'll be a priest or you'll be a high priest, That'll go as long as you continue to obey and things don't go wrong for you. But otherwise, it means as long as things existing continue. I'm going to put my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. I'll be looking at my name. I'm going to put my Shem there. That's the word name, Shem. Okay? Take a look at 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 7. Then I will cut off Israel from the land if they disobey, and I will give them and the house which I have consecrated for my name. I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. In other words, if they turn away from me after we built this house, I'm going to throw them out. And in 2 Kings chapter 21, verse 7, then he set the carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of the Eternal, said to David and to his son Solomon, in this house and in this Jerusalem, which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name. This is that was 2 Kings 21. And he set the carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Eternal said. That's the house where God said, you know, where the Eternal said to David, I'm going to put my name. And they polluted it, desecrated it. Now, I want you to read with me. I'm going to read Solomon's prayer, 1 Kings chapter 8, and beginning in verse 12. Let's take a look at it. Solomon said, the Eternal has said he would dwell in the thick cloud. I have surely built a lofty house, a place for your dwelling forever. Then the king faced about and blessed all the assembly of Israel. Now this is when the dedication of the temple, Solomon's great temple, is now finished. And Solomon is talking here and he's going to pray. He faced the people and he blessed all the assembly of Israel. And all the assembly of Israel was standing. And he said, blessed be the Eternal God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David and has fulfilled it with his hand, saying, since the day that I brought my people Israel from Egypt, I did not choose a city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house, that my name might be there. But I chose David to be over the people. First, he said, I didn't ask for a place to build for my name. I chose David. But it was in David's heart. Now, verse 17, it was in the heart of my father David, Solomon says, to build a house for the name of the Eternal. Not for the Eternal, but for the name of the Eternal, the God of Israel. But the Eternal said to my father, David, because it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who will be born to you, he will build the house for my name. Now, the Eternal has fulfilled his words. This is Solomon. He's talking to the people. The Eternal has fulfilled his word, which he spoke. For I have risen in place of my father David and sit on the throne of Israel, as the Eternal promised, and have built the house for the name of the Eternal God of Israel. There I have set a place for the ark in which the covenant of the Eternal, which he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Then Solomon, this is now verse 22, then Solomon stood before the altar of the Eternal and in the presence of all the assembly of Israel and spread his hands toward heaven. He's just looking up like this, spreading his hands toward heaven. And he said, O Eternal God of Israel, there is no God like you, in heaven above or on earth beneath, keeping covenant and allowing loving kindness to your servants who walk before you with all their heart, who have kept with your servant, my father David, that which you promised him. Indeed, you have spoken with your mouth and have fulfilled it with your hand as it is this day. Now therefore, O Eternal, the God of Israel, keep your servant David, my father, that which you have promised him, saying, you shall not lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel, if only your sons will take heed in their way to walk before me as you have walked. Now therefore, O God of Israel, let the word, I pray you, be confirmed which you have spoken to your servant, my father David. Let it all become right. Now listen to verse 27. But will God dwell on earth? Are we really saying, we build this house, is God really going to dwell here on earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house which I have built. You know, it's beautiful, it's great, it's a wonderful house, it's got gold, it's got all this stuff. Yet, you have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his supplication. O eternal my God, to listen to the cry and to the prayer which you have, your servant prays before you today, that your eyes may be opened toward this house night and day, toward the place of which you have said, my name shall be there. To listen to the prayer of your servant and shall pray toward this place. Listen to the supplication of your servant and your people, which when they pray toward this place, here in heaven, your dwelling place, hear and forgive. Notice what's happened here. Solomon is acknowledging, we can't build a house for the great almighty God who dwells in the heavens, who knows everything. We can't build a house where we can contain you and put you here. We're not building a house to contain you. We're just building a house where you put your name there. You're going to put your name in that house, not you, because you are in heaven. And when people pray toward this house, toward your name, well, may you hear up in heaven and respond. The house doesn't have any power. It's the name that calls on you, but you're the one. He separates by having his name, but not himself, dwell in the temple. Both a high and a low estimation of the temple is achieved. You don't worship the temple. That's his name there. God is where? God is in heaven. So both a high estimation, because God's name is there, so we have to give the temple some respect. The eternal is not tied to the temple, but is enthroned in heaven. God is up in heaven. And you have this famous passage in the book of Isaiah, chapter 66. You remember that? This is the one of my very favorite passages in the whole Bible. It's in Isaiah 66, verse 1. Thus says the Eternal, heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is a house you will build for me? And where is a place that I may rest? For my hand made all. In other words, you're building this temple, you get some rocks, you get some boards, you get some this, you make some gold, you get some silver, you put some stuff, you overlay it, you draw things in it, you put all this stuff, you get the carpet, you get this, you get that. Where is the place that I may rest? My hand made all these things that you're building for me. Thus all these things came into being. I brought them into being, declares the Eternal. But to this one I will look, to him who is humble and contrite of spirit and who trembles at my word. We'll talk more about the Yahweh formula, the Tetragrammaton formula that shows God's name claiming the lordship of all the world in our next sermon.